From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. And this morning, Mary Beth Maziarz has a conversation with author Ted Page, who discusses his new book, Good Grandpa, about how the role of grandparents has evolved in recent years and ways that their presence in children's lives can be more helpful and satisfying than ever. Then we speak with organizational expert Vanessa Druscott, who dissects what makes for an emotionally intelligent team at work and beyond, and how to help every member of a collaborative situation feel valued while creating a result that far outperforms expectations. That all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. You're listening to KPCW Park City. We'll be right back.
Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. September 7th is this year's celebration of Grandfather's Day, a day when we can all hopefully be in touch with or take time to remember our grandfathers for all they are and all they do. And today's guest, Ted Page, has a special interest in grandfathers as an author, storyteller, performer, marketing executive, and most importantly, devoted grandfather himself on a heartfelt mission. Ted created the blog Good Grandpa in 2014 after realizing the cultural absence of meaningful resources for new grandfathers, a gap filled mostly with ads for dentures and nursing homes. Inspired, he began sharing his own journey into grandfatherhood and quickly discovered a deeper purpose, nurturing the next great generation through love, wisdom, and presence. We're thrilled to have you with the program today, Ted. Welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks, Mary Beth. It's a pleasure to talk with you about this.
So if you wouldn't mind, share a little bit more about your origin story of how you realized that you wanted to explore the role of grandfathers and really how to be and recognize what's great about grandfatherhood.
Well, it all began with my daughter, who one Valentine's Day invited us over and shared Valentine's cards with us. Right away, I should have known that was a giveaway because she doesn't usually give Valentine's cards. And inside was the sonogram. And, you know, we were just totally bowled over. And my wife and I hugged. I hugged my in-laws. I hugged the cat. I think I bawled my eyes out. But there was also this sensation that I'd been invited to a club that I wasn't ready for. You know, a tremendous gift, but I didn't know how to navigate this new life landscape. And the only reference I had was my own grandfather, and I was fortunate to know him, but he was also well into his 70s. And I just couldn't wrap my head around kind of being part of that image of him and that world of grandfatherhood. And the only thing I could find on the web was references of the movie Bad Grandpa. So that was the origin of writing about good grandpas. So I just needed to process, right? And as a writer, that's how I process things. So I just started writing stories, not how to, just stories about the experience. And over time, more grandfathers heard about it and started reaching out to me. And that's when it got really interesting, was hearing their stories. And it started to develop a larger picture along the way.
And if you're not familiar with the movie Bad Grandpa, it was a Jackass production with Johnny Knoxville dressed up like an elderly guy, just doing all kinds of crazy antics. And it is ridiculous and absurd and kind of funny, but it is not how most of us would like to see our grandparents. How do you find that the experience of being a grandfather, or even at that point, that early projection of what that experience might be like, was different from how you felt about becoming a father?
Becoming a father was a similar moment, but different. And, you know, I was there for both of my kids being born. I remember feeling like, you know, this is amazing. This is magic. This is all these things. But somehow when I became a grandfather, it wasn't just a change in that there was a new addition in my life. It was that I myself had changed. And it was a sensation of like rediscovering magic. It was the first time in a really long time in my life where, I don't know if you've ever used the word joy, but it, you know, it was more like sarcastic, or, you know, just saying, oh, I just finished a long meeting. Oh, joy. And all of a sudden, with my first grandson, and now with five of them, It's like, oh, joy. Like, that's what it is. You know what I mean? That's a really transformational thing to kind of have this second chance to be with these little kids who are part of me and part of this growing family. It's transformative in its own way that's different from parenthood.
So many grandparents say that they're more relaxed. The responsibility for the meat and the potatoes isn't really on them as much, and so they can have a little more nuance with how they relate to their grandchildren. Do you find that you're more relaxed as a grandparent, and does that help in your relationship with your grandkids?
I am totally relaxed and mostly having fun. And you mentioned meat and potatoes, so I'll bring up another food group that I've been known to share with my grandchildren. And it's a practice I started a few years ago, which is first thing in the morning, like if they're over for a sleepover or whatever, or we're babysitting, I give them chocolate, like before breakfast. I actually enlisted my grandsons to do a little book promotion to try to get a publisher on board, and the first th thing they said on the video was, "Yeah, and our grandpa gives us chocolate for breakfast." But it's funny because I found out that in my interviews with various grandfathers for the books, including an imam and a Chinese gentleman, how common that is, that we as grandfathers have a bit more liberty and freedom to express our love for these kids through treats and experiences that are just fun without the parental responsibilities, really. And the kids pick up on that. So we're part of this different experience for them, where we're a little less, judging of, dietary restrictions, so forth, but we have that liberty. So I think that's part of developing, a special bond with them. That makes it a very special time to be with them.
Well, in your book, too, you mention rabbis, priests, Chinese, Indian, combat vets, people from all walks of life, all different cultures. Do you find that this reinvigorated vision of grandfatherhood is something that's happening across many cultures?
I believe it is, and it's hard for me to tell with the other cultures. Indian and Chinese in particular, because in terms of that, being present, I think it's actually more common in the Chinese and Indian cultures. The grandparents often live with families in communities, which is the way it used to be here in the United States. I talked to grandfathers who, for example, had their childhoods in Brooklyn, and they would just go next door and be with their grandparents, and that was such a special thing. And we've become much more dispersed. So I think that's something that we could all benefit from is that physical presence wherever possible. I do think in the United States, from what I've seen, there is a generational shift going on from my parents' generation to today in a number of levels, in that if you were an active dad, which I was, then you're going to be an active grandfather. You're going to be more present, right? My dad, who was great, he would have these very highly curated moments with the kids. And one of them I wrote about, which was totally, off the rails by today's standards, but my dad was a scientist, so he brought my 8 and 10-year-old kids out in the lawn to do an autopsy on mice to see the cause of death. Now he was a scientist, right? So it was a mind-blowing experience for my kids. They cut open the stomachs and the mice, and they found it was full of mouse poison pellets. Now, that was, a eureka moment. And you know what? My daughter cited that as one of the reasons why she chose getting her master's in science, was this amazing experience with my dad. But it was highly curated, right? Versus having just more time with kids. And I think that is a change. Like the younger grandfathers in particular, not just grandfathers, but in general, I think today's parents who are becoming grandparents are embracing the role more than past generations.
That makes a lot of sense, kind of that quality time versus quantity time that we hear about, that kind of shift to recognizing that sometimes you can curate amazing, life-changing moments, and sometimes just being around for whatever's happening is pretty amazing as well.
I think it's that it's the presence, right? And this is where my Aunt Lois, my late Aunt Lois, she was the first person I spoke with of my parents' generation because she was the only one still with us at the time. She was a great grandmother. And I said, how do I do this? And she said, be there for them. And I kept waiting for, more explanation, but that was really it, just to be there for them. Because when we do the things that we love to do, those are the things that our grandkids pick up on. So it's us kind of, doing what Joseph Campbell said, right? Follow your bliss. If you follow your bliss and you do those things that you love to do with your grandkids, then that's part of our legacy, but it's also a great, great time together.
Well, you write a little bit about the digital awakening of grandparenting. As you mentioned a moment ago, we don't always live nearby our grandparents or our extended families anymore due to lots of reasons. If you don't happen to be within a close geographic proximity to your grandchildren, what other ways can you stay connected?
It's funny, I recorded a podcast this morning for another show, and this very same thing came up because I think it's such a common challenge for grandparents. There's an organization called the Long Distance Grandparent, and they coach grandparents on how to stay connected in a digital way. So if you're across the country, around the world, like at Zoom calls like this, or they're sending letters every month. There's all kinds of ways to stay connected across distances, so that they can have more of an influence and have more of a relationship. The other thing I'm seeing, our parents, my parents, who Tom Brokaw, he called the greatest generation, they didn't have the internet. And the internet, while it has its major flaws and is a tremendous fear of the content and toxic media and so forth, but we are the first generation of grandparents in history who can blog and we can have Zoom calls. So my blog is sh sharing stories in the Good Grandpa blog and the sharing stories of other grandfathers. There's about 10 blogs of grandmothers who do the same thing. And it's through the storytelling that we're often able to pass on the wisdom that helps the next generation have a better life, right? And this was happening 30,000 years ago when the first grandparents came on the scene. They could teach families how to plant seeds and do other things to support the community. And that was the beginning of an era in humanity, the blossoming of arts and science in more healthy communities. Grandfathers, thankfully, due to better longevity, there's been a 10-year increase in male longevity since 1950. That 10 years, that was the 10 years I knew my grandfather. I was lucky, but more and more there are kids who have an opportunity to know their grandfather, to know their grandmother, and to hear those stories that can make a difference to them, whether it's done online or in person.
You mentioned The Greatest Generation, Tom Brokaw's book, and when you think of The Greatest Generation, or when I do, I think of Strong and Silent. And sometimes a lot of men from that era not being incredibly emotionally available just because of many of the things that they went through. Do you feel that that has shifted as we've emerged into new generations and that the emotional lexicon of today's grandfathers is helping those relationships?
I think so. And that's such a healthy change. My dad, who was a World War II vet, he was dive bombed at Okinawa. He had terrible post-traumatic stress, which we didn't really understand at the time. I'll tell you one brief experience of his time. Like, not only did he not say often, like, I love you, I didn't hear that till he was actually a grandfather. He was much older. But I begged him when I was maybe 11 or 12. Can you take me to the circus? I'd always wanted to go to the circus. So my dad was the classic man in the gray flannel suit, successful executive, but my mom was a stay-at-home mom. Dad went to work and, breadwinner and all that. So one day he says, okay, Ted, let's go to the circus. He's wearing a suit. And I'm thinking, why is he wearing a suit to go to the circus? He takes me to Ringling Brothers in Boston, this huge crowd, goes way up in the stand, sits me down and says, okay, we're at the circus. I'll see you in a couple hours. And he split. This is why I'm not fond of clowns. Like, to this day, I do not want to look at clowns because I was so freaked out at the circus by myself. I didn't know till years later he'd gone to pick up his mom at the airport. But for him, he checked the box, took me to the circus, and not long after that, I was very upset, naturally. But he always wrote notes to himself. And little pocket notes. I came across a note that was right next to notes, on the stairs saying, like pick up dry cleaning or what have you. And it said, love Ted. He'd actually written himself a note to remind himself to love me, right? So I think as kids of parents like that, who were scarred by their own life experiences or just through the norms of the time, we learn as much from them of what not to do as what to do. So, from a very young age, my wife and I, always said how much we loved our kids, right to them, hugging and every, and to this day, and my kids are the same way with their kids now. Like they don't say goodbye without saying I love you. And that's a healthy thing. But we're learning all across the way, and I'm still learning kind of how to navigate this.
We all are still learning all the time. Well, as men live longer, you mentioned that there's a 10-year extra longevity these days. We get that gift of more time with our grandparents and our grandfathers, but we also face more health issues and more mental decline, Alzheimer's, things like this are a big deal. Do you find that there are any ways we could approach that if you have a grandfather in your life who still is a part of things, but is really struggling with some health or mental issues?
Yeah, I approached it from the perspective of, grandfathers dealing with health issues because it is a natural part of life that you have challenges along the way, right? Our bodies degrade over time. So I started with a story of my own experience where I had undiagnosed hernia and, like 6 months of hell and pain and that resolving. But I thought, how do doctors do this? How do doctors who are grandfathers deal with their own challenges? So I interviewed two guys. And it was really revealing to learn about it. And one of them in particular was someone who reached out to me. His name is Dr. Jan Lippis. And he started out as an emergency room doctor. He'd always wanted to be a painter, but his parents pushed him into medicine. And at a certain point in his life, he became the patient. And he started having these debilitating physical attacks. Turns out he had MS. So he kept working in a wheelchair in an emergency room, zipping around, eventually only had the use of one hand. And finally, he said to himself, you know what? I'm not getting any younger. I'm not getting any healthier. I'm going to be a painter. So he learned how to paint with his non-dominant left hand, quit medicine, and became a successful painter and sold out all his shows. He's an amazing painter. And now he has grandkids. And he describes his time with these grandkids. Teaching them to paint, doing treasure hunts, all while adapting. He calls it a kind of unmitigated joy. So, but his main lesson was adapt. You can always adapt, like whatever it is, find a way. His wife helps him to, they're going to play cards, right? You can't hold the deck of cards with two hands. He's only got one hand. He has a device that helps him hold the cards to learn how to paint. He has one hand for a brush. But his wife helps and he has other ways to adapt. So that was an important lesson. And, I think just kind of going with it and not freaking out over medical issues you have, but just keep living.
Yeah, that's perfect. I love the way he was able to make such a positive shift in his life. So many people feel like, well, this is the end of the road if they have a setback that's significant.
Yeah, it totally put my own petty challenges, in perspective. I thought, if this guy can feel unmitigated joy, yeah, he gives his kids, grandkids, rides in his electric wheelchair. It's like, that's the image right there.
Right.
Smiling, happy, zipping along with kids riding your wheelchair. It's like, just make it happen wherever you are in life.
Right. Well, I know you didn't set out to write your book, Good Grandpa, as an advice manual or anything like that. And it is full of really entertaining stories. But you probably did pick up a few through lines of wisdom. Are there a few things that you'd especially like to share with listeners that you think is just really great to know or to apply to your relationship with your grandkids?
I'll tell you some things that rose to the surface because part of my mission in trying to think about, how do we nurture the next great generation? And that was through where I had conversations with Tom Brokaw and John Cleese and ultimately got wisdom from the Dalai Lama as well, who shared his number one wisdom.
You really went slouching for these
Yeah.
contributors, I have to say.
Yeah. I did want to connect with Paul McCartney, but he was too hard. He's got tons of grandkids. I couldn't get through to him. But I did hear two things out of all the grandfathers I spoke with. that were more common than others. One was just be kind to all the people in your life, just be nice to people. One grandfather said, in a doggy dog world, you have to exceed the golden rule. So it's not just the standard golden rule, it's be nicer to others than you anticipate they will do unto you.
Yeah.
Another thing I heard was, you're going to have some tough times, right? And this is something Tom Brokaw talked about. You're going to have some challenges in your life, but you're going to survive. You're going to be okay. Trust yourself, learn from whatever happens, and keep going because you're going to get there. And it actually didn't fully hit me till I had finished the book and sent in the manuscript that those two ideas are totally synergistic. And we're having a bit of a national moment night right now, which is based on strength and, being tough. And I'm all for having masculinity as part of our culture, but we are strongest and most resilient when we are kind. Because sooner or later, and you can be the toughest person in the world, you can be a big, strong man. I'm 6 foot 6, but I'll tell you, my success is not based on my height or my strength. It is based on when times get tough, all those people that we are nice to and kind to, those are the ones who are there for us. And whether we're a citizen, just a person, or a country, we have to remember that kindness and strength go together.
I think so too. Well, there are some great examples in your book of generational love languages, of the specific ways that some grandfathers bond or share, just spend time with their grandkids. You mentioned that your grandfather showed love by splitting wood with the grandsons. Grandmother expressed her love through poetry. What kind of other examples came up when you spoke with people on your blog or for the book?
There were celebrities that I had connected to, but mostly you just guys like me who shared their stories. One of them, his name is Buck Weaver. He's a retired orthodontist, and he was most of the year with his wife in Key West. And I connected with him in Zoom. I called it Zoom Land because I kept going to Zoom Land to meet with people. But he spent the first 5 minutes of my conversation with him talking about monarch butterflies and how his part of Key West is this way station for the monarch butterflies. And they go, and he and his grandson spend time looking at the monarchs. And they actually repaired the wing of a monarch at one point so it could fly on. That kind of struck me as an idea that was bigger, right? Because it was this love of nature, but it was doing the things that we love, and it was a bonding experience for him and his grandson. But I also found there was a larger metaphor there, because when I researched monarch butterflies, they start north of where I am right here in Vermont, right? They start in the northeast, and then they eventually end up in this rare section of forest in Mexico, rainforest. But it's something like 4 or 5 generations of monarchs. They'll stop and they'll reproduce, they'll rest, and a new generation will fly on the next distance. It was that conversation with him where he was talking about helping these monarchs continue the journey. But I thought, in a way, that's what grandparents help bring about, because we're helping at our best, support that next generation so they can continue the journey. But I loved what he was doing with his grandkids. It was the taking care of the monarchs and just going swimming and learning the names of the fish. And what a fantastic legacy to love nature.
And to share your passions that way, in the same way that the mice autopsies did. Whatever it is that fires you up is fun to share with others.
Yeah, exactly. Like, whatever it is you like. Like, for me, like, I love telling stories. So, I now spend time with my grandkids just telling stories, and they tell me stories. They tell me amazing stories because, that's something we do together.
And I think that circuit of not only passing on things, but letting them share things to you too, it becomes this wonderful, I don't know, this cycle of life thing that it keeps you young and it helps them grow and mature. And it's an incredible contribution to both of your lives.
It
Well,
is. I have to say, I turned 66 this year, and when I'm hanging out with my grandkids, and my grandsons call me bro, by the way, which I find hysterical. It's like, hey, bro, let's go out and eat. It's like, okay. But there is, I feel like I've kind of rediscovered my inner 12-year-old, So I'm 66, going on 14 at this point.
Well, we're talking with Ted Page, storyteller, performer, and now author of a book called Good Grandpa. And your blog is also called Good Grandpa, is that correct?
Goodgrandpa.com. Yeah, I love it when people reach out to me through the blog. There's a contact page. I love hearing people's stories. Yeah, reach out to me at ted@goodgrandpa.com, and I love to have a conversation.
Well, this has been a really great conversation, and all of us who have grandfathers in our lives or just remember them really fondly, we'll take an extra moment this Sunday on September 7th, which is Grandfather's Day, to do that. And hopefully they'll go out and check out your book, Good Grandpa, by Ted Page, and find new ways to interpret the grandfather experience and to apply it to their lives. Ted Page, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Today, we're diving into the fascinating world of teamwork, leadership, and emotional intelligence. Our guest is Dr. Vanessa Druscat, renowned organizational psychologist and co-author of the book Emotionally Intelligent Teams.
With years of groundbreaking research under her belt, Druscat explores how the best teams go beyond technical skills to master the emotional dynamics that drive collaboration, resilience, and performance. Whether you're leading a team or working within one, her insights promise to be both practical and transformative. Dr. Druscat, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here with you.
Well, let's just start out with what's your working definition of emotional intelligence?
I think of emotional intelligence as data. So using emotion as data and then being very conscious about what you're going to do with that data. So for example, when you feel nervous or when you feel excited, you're aware of it. It's information. And what does it mean for who you're with and how you want to present yourself and how you want to put your best self forward? That's my definition.
That's perfect. And do you feel like we're finally at a moment where people can accept the idea that being self-aware and, I don't know, emotionally agile is a valuable part of the business model? I think for many, many years, it felt like everyone thought they needed to be buttoned up and being professional meant being reserved, or being professional meant keeping your emotions, or even just feelings in general out of the equation.
Yeah, I really think that we are on the a wave of change in that direction. So I see it in a lot of organizations. I still don't see it in some organizations. I would consider them to be more masculine in general. But when I work with them, when they have problems and they bring me in, it's amazing how much more communication happens, how much more helping and sharing, working together, collaboration occurs when you recognize that there is no motivation without emotion. And when you recognize people, especially when they're in groups, have emotional needs, for example, the need to be feel accepted or feel valuable, things like that. It makes a big difference to performance.
And then, Vanessa, this concept of teams, I was thinking about it that so, quite often people don't even realize they're on a team, or they don't think of it that way, unless you're on something, in life, whether it's, a sports team, for example, that has the moniker team, or at work, you're assigned to a specific team. And I hear that more and more, that concept of a team in work settings. And just introducing that concept, I mean, what, 20 years ago, we never talked about a team. And so, what should that mean to people? And how often do you encounter people that don't actually realize they're on something called a team?
Yeah, that's actually really common. People want to know, well, what are the boundaries? When is something a team? When is something a department? And best definition for that is that if you have a shared goal, if you need each other to get your work done, then you're probably a team. So if you need to interact with other people, in order to get your work done. So, for example, if, Mary Beth needs something from Lynn in order to complete her work, then there's a good chance you're a team. And I like to say that the more often you interact, the more important it is for you to be an emotionally intelligent team. So if you're not interacting very often, if you're just passing papers back and forth and you can just communicate, when your relationship is more of what we call an exchange relationship. So you're exchanging information. You may need each other, but you're just basically exchanging. Then you're a little more like a group than a team. You become a team when you've got back and forth interaction and you're creating something that meets your shared goal. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are quite often on teams without it actually being called that. And then, you're introducing this concept, which is not new anymore, of emotional intelligence and how to kind of set up, even a group as small as two could be a team. And it's all about kind of laying down the groundwork and being expressive and open about expectations. Or structure? How does it work? How do you start?
Well, you start by exactly creating a structure. So anytime you have to work with others, you have to have, coordinated interactions. And you can just get together and start working, and then a structure will emerge. Structure always emerges. So, for example, how do you start your meetings? Do you start them on time? Do you have an agenda? Do you who talks the most? These are structures. We call these social structures that basically just emerge. It works far better if you consciously develop a structure that works for you. So, for example, you can say, look, it's really important to me that we start on time. All right, who's in on that? Great. That's how we're going to work. Then it's really important to me that we begin with just 5 minutes of chit chat and checking in, find out how everybody's day's gone so far. That can be part of your structure. And then just simply, is it do we does everybody talk? Does one person talk? Have we done reading before we've come? Do we do the work during the meeting? So, for example, at Amazon, they have this policy where the first few minutes of every meeting, people are reading things. So that you don't have to prep before you come to the meeting, you prep in the meeting. And they move to this, I'm assuming, because people weren't prepping before the meetings. But anyway, that's a structure that they've developed. So anyway, my whole contention, my whole model, my book focuses on the structures that you can create to build the kind of team that you want to have that can make you more productive.
That sounds great because it seems like so many times there's friction or resentment because somebody's doing something that's making somebody else irritated. And they don't always know what that is because it's not spoken. When you're helping teams figure out what their expectations and their hopes and their preferences are, is how does that process work?
Sure. So, just stepping back for a second, I spent basically 30 years of, well, let's say 20 years. I've been studying and working with teams for 30 years. First 20 years, I spent going into organizations and studying what were the social structures in the highest performing teams in organizations, and what were the social structures in your typical or average teams, and comparing those so that I could learn. Across industries, what was it that the highest performing teams did in common? And so my colleagues and I went in, we interviewed, we videotaped with permission, of course. We surveyed, we've tried to figure out what's the secret sauce for being a high performing team. So we did that research for 20 years, and then we spent another 10 years going out into organizations and applying what we'd learned to see if we could build great teams that way. So everything I'm about to tell you about comes from that 30-year period.
Okay.
What we've discovered is that there are three categories of what we call social norms. Social norms are routines, habits that again emerge as part of the structure in a team. Every team has a social structure. Every team has norms. These are the norms that we've seen in the highest performing teams. So, three categories. One, we call it how we help one another succeed. This focuses on the individuals. This helps take care of the individual needs in the team. So, we've known for a long time that if you don't meet the needs of the individuals, you have problems, just exactly the kind you were just talking about, Mary Beth, where people feel certain things, feel frustration. They're frustrated. They don't have enough control. They don't have enough recognition. No, everybody's ignoring them. So these are the kinds of things that we find get satisfied in structures in the highest performing teams right off the bat. So that's the first key set of norms. Second set of norms is about evaluating how well we're doing and tweaking our structures. And proactively creating an environment that works. And then the third set of norms is about reaching outside and bringing in experts and people who are stakeholders, customers, your boss's boss, et cetera, can give us information that can help us improve. And so the norms that fall into those three categories are the ones that differentiate the great teams from just the typical and average teams.
That makes a lot of sense. It's for those who are listening, we're talking with Vanessa Dreskett, author of a new book called Emotionally Intelligent Teams. This is reminding me a little bit of, one of our Utahns here, Stephen Covey's book, Habits of Highly Effective Families, Highly Effective People, about buying in. Like we all have to buy in and on these values or precepts that are that we're going to agree as a team are a healthy process for us. Do you feel that that is applicable to families or other situations, or is this mostly meant for the workplace?
It's a great question. I focus it on the workplace, but I think it's meant for families too. I mean, it's pretty basic stuff. I like to say it's not rocket science, but it's not very common either, right? Same thing with Covey's. And also, the details become important. For example, we all have a need to feel valuable. And whether you're sitting around your family dinner table, if you know what if, whether people are actually listening to you and answering your questions and including you, those kinds of micro behaviors help you to feel valuable. So those are the kinds of things that we build into that first cluster of norms. And in fact, the first cluster, about how we help one another succeed, the first one is it helps people feel known. It's called understand team members. So you really got to know what people care about, what makes them unique, what they bring, their personality. The more one of the things we've learned is that the more you know about people, first of all, the more you like them. The more you're willing to include them, and the more they feel a sense of belonging in that group, right? So you can imagine that being just as important at the family dinner table or during the family vacation as it is in a team. And it's not always consciously included in the norms in either group.
Vanessa, I'm wondering, as you're talking, I guess, and maybe our listeners are wondering this also, we've all been involved in teams where there is this attempt that feels very contrived at getting to know each other on your team and doing team building exercises and days, and it's all very rah-rah and let's all get on board with this, yet it's lacking something. It's so unevolved, I guess. And what it makes me feel like, and I was involved in an organization like this, where the person at the top was that cheerleader and really had all these great intentions, but it wasn't, it's not that it wasn't sincere, it just wasn't a very evolved way of creating this interest in each other. And so I'm wondering if there's, you arrive in the group and it's the first day and everyone go you go around the circle, you tell a little bit about yourself, and we've all been there 100 times.
Right.
Is there a new way to do that?
Yeah, there's absolutely a new way to do that. And I've been there too, and it's nobody likes to have that forced on themselves. So, but I want you to remember that the norms that in the model come from observing and really getting to know the highest performing teams in organizations. So, for example, in at one organization we did this research in was Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceuticals. Okay. They wanted to know why their very best drug development teams were did so well and why their typical ones weren't quite up to the same standard. So let me tell you that in these highest performing teams, it's not done with a rah, rah, rah attitude. All right. So it's not a one and done activity. We get together, we find out when we're checking in. It's more like, so what do you think's working well in the team right now? What are you nervous about in the way that we're working? What are you nervous about right now? And so people, you unveil, what you do is bit by bit, you unveil what's real to these people. And yeah, you gotta work up to that. Which is something we discovered when we were building this in teams. But I'll tell you, unless you feel known and understood and valued, truly listened to, you don't become a high-performing team. And the only way out is through. So everybody always wants to know, how do you build trust? How do you build psychological safety? And I got to tell you that it is through getting to know one another in a more authentic way, with more authentic questions, and you turn it into a routine or a habit. It's not a one and done exercise. So what ends up happening is I end up being able to predict, what Lynn's going to do, what Mary Beth is going to do, what your needs are, so that when we're in the thick of it and we're trying to meet our deadline, and it's the holiday season, and we all want to get home. And we are more efficient because I know how I need to say it to you. They do this with a level of care that enables them to just shoot back and forth and disagree. Let me bring up one of Stephen Covey's. I love Stephen Covey's work, by the way. One of his great principles is the emotional bank account. I don't know if you remember that from his book. So I like to use that when I talk about, well, how respected do I need to feel? How much do you need to coddle me in the group or value me? Well, you need to know that you're cared about. We need to deposit some care and respect and love, if you will, in that emotional bank account enough that when we take out withdrawals and we say, hey, Vanessa, stop. We got it. We don't have time for this. We're all trying to get home right now. That I don't take it so personally that I'm crushed, right? I know Mary Beth and Lynn care about me. I know this is how we work together. This is the way we do it. Anyway, that's what the very best teams do. And the only way to get there is through the pieces of relationship development.
So, what do you do if there's a person on the team who just seems a little determined to be a contrarian, or they say, I don't buy in on all this touchy-feely stuff? How do you help pull them in? Because they might be a terrific contributor, but this one thing is helping the team not in the way you're hoping.
Well, let me tell you, nobody likes that touchy feely stuff. So never been in an organization. Yeah, we've been in the decade, more than a decade that we were rolling out this model, going into some of these organizations where they were all engineers and bankers and financial folks. So what you have to do there is you don't focus it on touchy feely stuff. You focus it on, all right, who are we? What do you need to know about me, in order to work with me? And then we still engage in the norms. So, right now we're talking about this, the individual level of norms. We know that in order to feel a sense of belonging, in order to feel a sense of trust, that you need to be known, valued, mutually supported. That's got to be pushed off the table. That's got to be checked off. I'll come back to a moment in a moment to your person who's a troublesome person. So hang on, I'm not going to forget that. But there are other norms in there too, which is that we create together a shared sense of where we're going. We have this discussion together. We build it together. We talk about it, and every voice is heard in that. So people have a sense of control over the narrative that we're using to define how we're going to move forward. That's super, super important. We actually have a human need to want to build a shared sense of understanding about where we're going. As a, there's books on my shelf, this thick on how important that is when you're in a team to feel like you share this sense, this model of how to move forward. Okay, coming back to the people who are problem people, I have never met a leader who doesn't have problem people in their team. And so the question is why that person is a problem person. My colleagues and I guess, maybe there's just 10% or 5% of people who just are shouldn't be on teams. And I've certainly helped leaders let go of people like that before, that they're just problematic for whatever reason. But most people who are problem people in teams are doing it for a reason. And I like to say that they're often the canaries in the mine. So the question is, in those conversations where you're building the shared sense of understanding, where you're revisiting your norms and you're saying, how are we doing? What do we need to change? They get a voice. And I can't tell you how often we've pulled in. Again, I want to tell you, I've never met a leader who doesn't have a problem person in the team. Once we start building shared norms and we knock these three, these norms in these three buckets, first we talk about who you are, what you need. Second, we talk about the shared understanding we're going to build together and everybody's included in that. And the third is that we reach out for new ideas all the time. Most of those bad team members fall right in. All of a sudden, they have an opportunity to voice what's been on their mind. They're no longer as frustrated. I mean, I have, 15 examples on the top of my tongue of when this has happened. I've had leaders say, "Oh, so and so is not even going to show up." That's how they are. That's how bad they are. Or if they do show up, no one's going to talk. Well, as soon as you start peeling the onion of who they are, and they start feeling like they have a little more control. Similarly, let me say one more thing, and then I'm going to be quiet, so because I know you have, I'm sure you have follow-up questions. I'm sorry.
All right.
We actually sometimes survey folks on their norms, right? And I'll tell you, the people with status love the norms. The people lower status have problems with them. So we can easily say, "Oh, you low status people, we don't care." But if you look at the range of the ratings, it's right there in front of our eyes. We have to say, what's going on? Why isn't everybody? What are we doing that's not including everyone in this team? That's where a lot of where we're improving, drawing in those bad team members can really happen when you have those discussions.
Wow, that's yeah, that need to be known, valued, and mutually supported is maybe the strongest in those people who don't seem to be buying in on things. Yeah.
Yeah, and they want more control over how the team operates. They want
Sure.
control over the norms.
Sure. Well, let me ask you this. So you mentioned at the outset of creating an emotionally intelligent team, you try to make sure that people are clear on who you are and what you need. Do we always know ourselves as well as we think we do? Or is there any feedback from the other team members about, well, it kind of seems like you do want this or that you're more like this? What do you find about that?
Yes. So first of all, one of the norms in that first cluster, the how we help one another succeed is a feedback norm. So people, what we do is we set teams up to give one another feedback. You can call it advice, and we help teams decide how they're going to do it. How often are you going to do it? Is it anonymous? But we are in a position to give one another feedback, and they deserve to know. Rather than people talking behind the back, they deserve feedback. So how you're going to roll that out varies from team to team. So there's that. The other thing is, one of the things that I found works really well, by the way, back to this issue of touchy-feely stuff. One of the things that we often do if we have the time to do it when we work with teams is we'll with one of the first activities we'll do is we'll if, especially if we're face to face, this becomes easy. We'll build a large piece of paper, poster paper that we'll put on the wall, and we'll give them images. We'll let them cut out images from magazines, or we'll give them postcards. And to describe themselves, they have to put up those images. And we'll ask four questions. What do you most need from a team that you're in? What do people most need to know about you? Who are you? What do you care about most? And we put these things up there, and people have to describe it through these images rather than through words. And it is just beautiful. It is amazing. Now, you can also do versions of that online, which we end up having to do a lot these days with remote teams. And and you can, or you can have people just bring those images to answer those questions to the meeting, the online meeting. And anyway, people unveil, we're never, none of us are static. We're always moving image, we're always moving, changing, developing, and anyway, that's one of the ways we try to slip that in there, that touchy feeling in there without people really knowing what they're doing.
I love that because it can be kind of subconsciously revelatory to them too about these things that they've chosen. Like, huh, look at that. All these images are me solo. Maybe I want a little bit more independence or what. It could be a million things, I'm sure. Well, we've been talking with Vanessa Dreskat and about her new book, The Emotionally Intelligent Team. And if you're a listener who thinks, oh, well, I'm not in a traditional business environment, or this doesn't, I'm a sole proprietor or whatever, this doesn't really apply to me, I think you might be mistaken. There are a lot of things in this book just about being human and getting along with people in the world and knowing what you want to accomplish and what the best and smoothest way to accomplishing that might be. Vanessa, thank you so much for being on the Mountain Life with us today.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Thank you so much. My great pleasure to be here with you both.
Thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City.